Hello and welcome to another episode of Sounds from the 70s with Gary and Rob, sometimes compared to Clint Eastwood's orangutan buddy from Every Which Way But Loose.
Sometimes, but not always.
Sometimes. coming to you from the sandy beaches of Acapulco, in my dreams. We're actually in a shack in the country by some sort of hill.
There's a lot of medical babies around us.
Use
your imagination.
There's a lot of people who seem to be inbred around here. Anyways, Rob.
Clyde.
Today's
left turn, Clyde.
get it? Okay, today's show, I know, is going to be an excellent show. Well, actually, let me rephrase that. A show that features jazz could never be an excellent show.
No, it can't. No, it cannot. I realized that this week.
It would have.
And I like the album.
It would have to feature any type of non-jazz album to be an excellent show. But it's a good one today. It's kind of good. It's kind of worth us coming down to the shack and doing it. I'll say that much.
Kind of worth you listening. Kind of.
I was actually... I'm not going to do it now because I have a... Today's also Bad Back show
bad back.
Today.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to do it. But I was actually... if I'm not... I'm kind of immobilized in my chair for the next hour.
Breathing is bad. You shouldn't be breathing.
Breathing hurts.
Don't breathe.
I was going to write down exactly what I thought... What I knew what I was going to say about today's album and what I thought Rob was going to say. And then at the end, I would show it and
we'd compare answers and see how close it was.
And see if I was right or not. I'm not going to do that now because it hurts to do it. But you have to trust me in what I'm.
There's a thing in your mind which is not yet committed to paper.
No, it's in my mind. Yeah, it's in my mind, but I can't. It just hurts too much.
Yeah.
So you got to trust me, Rob, that what I say after you... give your opinion of the album is what I was going to say. Okay.
Okay.
Because I don't lie. There's no. I don't lie about music. The only lie I lie about music I do is when people say, "Did you like that jazz album?" I say, "Loved it." So, anyways, we will be. That's terrible.
How is this getting lumped in with music?
I thought we were talking about music, and then all of a sudden you bring up jazz.
Are we getting some spoken word albums?
We're just joking. We don't. It's just that there's so many jazz jokes, and we don't actually mean it. It's just that they're, you know, it's the music that always gets kicked in the ass. And it's, okay. We will be reviewing an album by jazz guitar virtuoso Aldi Meola. Shit. Aldi Meola.
Let's try that.
I've said it right like forever, and then one time I don't was on the air.
I thought I was saying it wrong for
you. Okay, you know what?
We're gonna start again.
By jazz guitar virtuoso Aldi Meola, called Elegant Gypsy, released in 1977. I thought it was called Arrogant Gypsy.
But most gypsies are.
Because, oh man, they're arrogant. And but I checked it out, and it's actually called Elegant Gypsy. I remember this album very well. I'm not reviewing it
during the
year. But yeah, when I was first listening to music in 1977, this album was released. And it was a very popular album, and it was in all the trade magazines and all that stuff with advertisements. And of course, Aldi Meola was in all the every guitar magazine that my brother bought. He was in every one.
I heard of it in college when I was taking that crazy jazz thing.
It was one of those guys that everybody knew about if you were a musician.
Yeah, but also the guitar strings. He endorses a line of guitar strings, doesn't
he? Right.
So yeah, that's where everyone knows his name.
I didn't know he was so young, no. He made this album, Elegant Gypsy, when he was like 23. And that's pretty freaking amazing. I didn't know that because he... Not that he looks old, but he looks mature.
Yeah, and you think a guy...
You know what I mean? He looks like he's in his early 30s or something. Yeah,
and a guy that can play like that, you think has a few more years.
Yeah, that's what I meant, too. Yeah. You know, I really do look forward when we do a jazz theme, which we have done a couple, unlike Rob. Because I really do like the music. Like, not all of it, but I do like a lot of jazz music, unlike Rob. And because there are so many jazz jokes out there that I love to pull out a few out of the rabbit's hat. And so what I'm going to do today is, as an example of a jazz joke.
And these are just, they're not meant to be funny.
No, well, no, they're meant to be funny, but they're not meant to be our feelings about jazz. It's just that they're jokes. Rob, I shouldn't say that, because Rob is very whiffy-waffy on jazz, but I have a lot of jazz albums. Some of it I just don't understand at all. But we are competent enough to comment on and review jazz, right? Would you agree?
Yeah, we are, but... Whew.
Hey, one of my favorite albums of all time is Stark Magus by Miles Davis, which I have played literally...
A zillion times.
Yeah, and in my car, and I have played it everywhere, and also my favorite box set, of course everything is Miles Davis, is Miles Davis and Gil Evans. It's my favorite box set, and so I am very much a jazz fan, except some of it bewilders the fuck out of me. But anyways, okay, here's the joke. Okay.
Here's the joke.
This is an original joke. This is not a taken from the... internet joke. This
I got
is
my
a,
laugh all prepared.
This is actually a joke I wrote last night. So now it's not going to go over well because I'm setting it up with just big hoopla. And it's not that funny, especially with my back in pain. It's not going to be funny. But anyways, so the married man... Shut up. Yeah. Do that again. So the married man...
Tell me more.
kept his mistress a secret from his wife for the entirety of his marriage. It seems he always took his mistress to a jazz club when they would go out, and nobody ever found out.
No one goes to jazz club.
Because no one went to the jazz club. You see, if I have to explain it, it's not a good joke, but I laughed. Anyways, speaking of never finding out anything, Rob, how was your week?
Let's see. I'm kind of in between work right now, so I'm just milling about and spending my afternoons down at the local shopping mall. Sipping coffee with the senior citizens, and
I thought you were. You just said you just went to work today.
Yeah, it's a kind of work. It's a kind of work where I don't do any work or get paid, but I still gotta be away.
Okay, well, on that cheery note, odds and ends. Lost time is not found again. Last week, do you remember last week on odds and ends,
Rob?
The
one thing I remember last week is we had to cut some stuff because.
That wasn't odds and ends. That was our
the thing feature. After odds.
It was our thing.
It wasn't the actual album. It wasn't a review. It was the feature.
It was the feature. It was the segment that we were going to do that I had
which
to cut.
Which was not odds and ends.
Shut the fuck up. You're just confusing me. Okay. So last week on odds and ends, now we lost everybody to the garden show right now. Just on that.
Just on that. How unprofessional.
Last week on Odds and Ends, we told you about how guitar god Jeff Beck has just passed away the day before taping. Remember that?
Yeah.
Then I got home. It's not strange. It's sad, actually. Then I got home right after the show, I found out that Lisa Marie Presley had passed away. Ooh. And then when I woke up the next day, first thing I found out was that Robbie Bachman, the drummer of Bachman Turner Overdrive and brother of Randy Bachman, had passed away. And to say the least, it was not a good week for music people. And especially 3 days in a row, it was like,
yeah, yeah,
boom, boom, boom. It really was. It was
back
like
in the old days, like people didn't a few die. Years ago. No, you'd have like maybe someone famous dying like once a week, twice a week, maybe. And now it's like we got an obituary list every week.
Yeah, it's seriously that point where we are going to lose all these people from the 60s and 70s on a continual basis until there's nobody but the new breed. Oh, my God.
Which, they may have their obituaries printed, but no one's going to know. Because they're not that important. Because they're not as good as things from my rosy childhood.
Don't get controversial. Don't get old man grumpy.
Things were better when I was young.
I remember when music was good. You remember when music was good?
Now it's bad.
But I'm not. I don't have any sour grapes. But remember when it was good? Well, that's the reason we do this show, is because we're doing what we call the golden age of rock and roll, which is the 70s. And when you had about 10 good albums released, 10 excellent albums released a week. Now you've got 100 albums released a week, but...
Name one.
Thank you. Thank you. You did my punchline. I didn't have to say it. Thank you. One piece of good news on Odds and Ends I have is that I shared on the show a couple of years ago. Rob won't remember because Rob remembers nothing.
Absolutely nothing.
A couple of years ago, how I felt that singer-songwriter Judy Sill, a big favorite on this show, should have a documentary film made about her sad and tragic life. And that has been done, like I predicted. I didn't predict it would be done, but I said it should be done because it's a good story. It's a sad, sad story, but it's a very good story. And the movie is called Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Sill. It has been shown at a couple of film festivals in November and in this start of this year. And it will be able to be seen on a streaming site. But as of the taping of this show, we don't know yet which site it will be. There's negotiations to be done.
Oh, yeah. They still got to...
It really hasn't been seen by the public yet. It's been just been shown in like film festivals. And the movie has been getting rave reviews by people who have seen it, obviously, but including the people who knew Judy Sill personally say that it's an amazing movie. So I am anxiously awaiting to see it as I am a huge fan of Judy Sill. And hopefully sometime not too long from now this year, it will be on some sort of site, as they say. That's what the kids say. Hey, it's on a streaming site. And then I go, what's a streaming site? And then they laugh.
Oh, that's a field where you take all your clothes off and run around. It's a streaming site.
Also, if you're interested... which I have seen, the trailer is available to view on the internet. So just put in Judy Sill movie and or documentary and you will that will come up. I'm very anxiously waiting to see that because they do have some footage. There wasn't much footage a couple of years ago when we first started reviewing Judy Sill's two albums. But they did come up with a little bit more footage. And they came up with a little bit more of what happened to her. We did actually a pat on my back. We did actually a follow-up not too long ago about how when we first did Judy Sill so long ago, 4 years ago, we didn't know exactly what her last days were like. But we did a follow-up. I can't remember when it was.
It was the second album of hers.
And then we did the second album, Heart Food. But I didn't follow that up either with that. I actually followed it up, I think, on Odds and Ends. Where I just said there was an article that I found that had described her last days and how she got into a car accident. And so we kind of know now what her last days were like. Like I said, so sad. Nobody even knew. Even her good friends didn't even know that she had died for years and after she had died. But all that is made clear, I would assume, in a documentary. It seems to be made clear if you watch the trailer. It's a very good trailer. If the trailer is anything like the movie, it's going to be an enlightening film, if incredibly sad. But that's enough of that, because that's enough of sad news. We have enough sad news right now with my back.
Sometime in the future, we won't be coming with you obituaries of musicians who passed away. We'll be coming to you with their birthdays. We'll be telling you, one new musician has been born today, and he's going to do great work in 30 years.
Oh, my thing stopped.
But that's still coming.
Oh, I never started it.
And that's how my week was.
I never started it. So I just realized that how I keep time on the show because we don't have our producer anymore because Uptown Mike was an idiot.
Just take that to what you got on the
phone. I thought I started it, but I guess I kind of didn't. So I'm on like 1 minute.
Yeah, what did you just add 15 minutes to that and you'll be on?
About 50 minutes?
15 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. So today we are, we can finally do
that segment.
This segment that we have delayed for 3 weeks now because it was two, we had to cancel it twice. So today shut the fuck up.
we're not going to go over today.
If you keep on doing that shit, we will not be able to do it again.
Here comes the segment.
I'm sorry for my outburst. Did I tell you I have a bad back? And unfortunately, when I have a bad back, Rob has to pay for my surliness.
As you say, when his back is bad, there are many things which aggravate it.
Like Rob aggravates me already. Like every week.
Yeah, this is extra. Wow, I'm not even paying for this.
So today we are going to finally get to part two of our series about the greatest years in rock and roll history, according to me, which I think everybody would agree on. If somebody doesn't agree, they can write me and I'll say, bullocks to you, sir, or madam.
Bullocks.
Bullocks. Greatest years in rock and roll history with our look at the year 1964. She loves you, yeah. That's where the music would come in. And you say, the year 1964. Beatlemania. So anyways.
That was a cheap beginning of a documentary.
Now, that's exactly what I was kind of imitating. 1964, very easily identifiable as, of course, the year the British invasion happened and everything changed. And, you know, in this day and age, in fact, even when I was growing up at the end of the 70s, I started listening to music. And that was a long time ago, 10, 20, 30, 40, 45 years ago. The knowledge that in 1964, when the Beatles and then all the British invasion bands came, there were no bands like that. And for some reason, it has never registered to me until now that there were no bands like that.
What about the Swingin' Blue Jeans?
That's around 1963, 64. Now, there were the Beach Boys. Now, the Beach Boys, now you're probably saying, hey, man,
back up.
Back up, man. What about all that? Like, there were bands. There were bands that sang. I'm not just saying do up, but there were bands that, you know, like Dionne and the Belmonts and stuff like that. They were vocal bands, and they had a backing band. And then there are bands like the Buckinghams who sang vocals and had a backing band. And then there were bands that did their own, they played their instruments in the band, but they were mostly instrumental. In fact, a lot of the stuff that the Beatles worked on when they first formed was just instrumental stuff, or like these singles from Little Richard. But a lot of the stuff, and I've heard it because I'm a huge Beatle fan, and I've heard their demo tapes from when they were the Beatles before they became famous and they were rehearsing. And a lot of stuff was just the Ventures type of instrumental stuff, the stuff they first wrote. The only song that Paul McCartney and George Harrison wrote together was In Spite of All the Danger. I can't remember.
It was a thing.
It was an instrumental.
Okay.
And so when you had a band, you did instrumental music or you did other people's music. The one exception was the Beach Boys, who not only played their instruments, but wrote their own music with Brian Wilson, of course. And but they kind of, even though I just love the Beach Boys and Brian Wilson is a genius, they were kind of playing surf music. They weren't playing the kind of music the British Invasion had. So don't tell me that there weren't any bands that did that. But the only one I can think of, to be truthfully honest with you, right now at this moment, is the Beach Boys, that were actually playing their instruments and playing concerts and also wrote their own music. So you have to understand that, and I know it's hard, but like you had Gene Vincent and the Blue Caps But you didn't have... You know what was an exception? I apologize. Was Buddy Holly. Because Buddy Holly was actually called... Their album was called The Crickets. And the Chirping Crickets. Buddy Holly... And I think that's why they were so influential, especially in England. That's why the Beatles called themselves The Beatles... was because of the Crickets. They were one of the few bands that were actually a band. And then when they became famous, it became Buddy Holly and the Crickets. But they actually did start out as a band with Buddy Holly as the leader, but just the Crickets. Very interesting. I remember that. So yeah, there was very, very... What we're saying is what we have after 1964, which was everybody wanted to be in a band. Compared to everybody was in a band, but they were playing like...
Yeah, it's either instrumental or you're backing up a singer.
Yeah, that's basically the way it was. I didn't fully realize that, to be honest with you, until this year. I didn't, I knew about it in the back of my head, but I never really fully got the grasp of it. So when the Beatles came in on January 1st, 1962... and did their audition for Decca, and they were rejected. And the guy there, I think Dick Rowe, said to them, "No, Mr. Epstein, I can't sign them. Groups are on their way out." What he meant was, and I didn't understand that, because I said, "Oh, there's so many groups out there, Jerry and the Pacemakers and blah, blah, blah." What he meant was, I think, was that, instrumental rock, and even though they weren't instrumental, he was kind of thinking, well, when they record, they'll probably record instrumental songs or whatever, and
that's
what, because that's what was, what it was done. And and he was kind of right in a way, in that it was all basically singers, it was all basically teeny boppers. It was a bad time in 1962, as you know, with all the big wigs from the 50s, not doing well, or Little Richard going into the ministry and Buddy Holly dead and Elvis coming back from the army and all that stuff. And it was all Fabian and all these teeny boppers, and the only real groups again that were making any was the Phil Spector groups like the Crystals. But they were singers, right? They were a group singers, and the band was... I know I'm belaboring this point.
I'm thinking the folk acts were, they had a few, but...
That's folk. That's folk, though. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I really am belaboring this point, but I am, because it's very important to realize, and it's amazing over the years how many musicians I have heard, and I wasn't born yet, and neither was Rob, but... when the Beatles performed and came to the U.S. and performed on the Ed Sullivan Show on February 9th, 1964, I still am so amazed when I hear this person say on an interview, or that person said, that's when I wanted to pick up a guitar, because I realized I could be in a band and I could sing the music. And I never fully understood that. I understood it, but I said, well, why couldn't you do it before? And now I realize why they couldn't do it before, because it wasn't done.
It never crossed their minds to do it, because that's not how it was done.
Even Neil Young, who has released a lot of his music over the last 10 years or so that's been in his archives, started out playing instrumental music in his band. He formed a band, and all they did was play instrumental music. And then the Beatles hit, and they said, we're not going to play instrumental music anymore. So what they mean was, yeah, now we can form a band. We don't have to back up anybody. We don't have to do this. We can actually get four of us together and be in a band. And it seems like everybody in the world, at least in North America, did that once they saw the Beatles. Like, I don't think there's anything that has affected rock and roll music, or maybe even music, to the effect that February 9th did when the Beatles were on the Ed Sullivan Show. And I don't think for the length of my life until recently, I have actually understood that until now. It's taken me a long time to process what life was like back then. I never understood what life was like back then musically. I always understood it by the songs. I never understood it by the culture, which was there were no bands. There was the Beach Boys before that. There was the Crickets.
I recall the Beatles an interview. I don't know who was talking, but they were mentioning that the Crickets were their inspiration to just be a band.
Yes, that's what I mean. The Crickets were an inspiration for many bands because they were like the only band that kind of did it. And everybody liked the Beach Boys, but they didn't play the type of course, music that most of the English people liked. They were very like sunny California music, as much as I love the Beach Boys. I don't mean to put them down, but it was a different type of music that it would become later on. But like we talked before, and we're going to talk about this on almost every year we do in this series, is that it's not like it just happened. These bands were playing in England. In America, there were none. Literally, there were almost none. There was like a guy fronting a band, and they would be the
Joe band. And the band of some weird...
You'd have Otis Redding and backed by Booker T and the MGs and stuff like that. But you didn't have a band that wrote their own material and went out there and sang it and all that stuff. But in England, you had all these bands. They didn't just form because the Beatles were there. They were there. Just like when we talked about, you know, Elvis didn't just appear and then all of a sudden, oh, I can do it, you know, and then a year later, it was all brewing at the same time. It took one group or person like Elvis did in 54 to open up the floodgates to all these people who were playing around, but now they were getting signed because it was the new revolution in music. Same thing. There were the Jerry and the Pacemakers. There were the Rolling Stones. There were all these groups. There were Hermes. Oh, I love Hermes. I'm Henry the Eighth. I am. It's one of the funniest songs ever.
Henry the Eighth.
I don't mean it's funny. I just mean because it's just like one verse and that's it. And it's like I always wanted to do that because I always wanted to do that live because I just wanted to sing that same verse over and over again like five times until everybody just got mad. And then there were the Animals and the Small Faces, and they were all there, and the Who. Some of them actually, you know, some, like the Who, they were kind of a different band before the Beatles hit, like in 63, 64, they were kind of like mod band that, you know, kind of was not more rhythm and blues, but anyways, what I'm saying is that these bands in some way were there. They just weren't getting signed because why? I don't think they're going to sell. Nobody want, like you told Brian Epstein, hey, I don't, guitar bands, that's what they said, guitar bands. Guitar bands are not, they're on the way out. Now when I remember what he said, that's what he meant, guitar bands, as in the Ventures and the Shadows and stuff like that, the instrumental bands. And it's funny, all these years I actually understand now what he meant. And he was right in a way, because those bands' days were numbered. They never expected like vocal bands who wrote their own material. People didn't write their own material.
Yeah.
You got your own material from Tin Pan Alley.
One club, and then you had the musicians, they were the other club.
In London, you got your music from Denmark Street and their kind of Brill Building there. And then you got, in America, you got your songs from the Brill Building and the, as they call it, Tin Pan Alley. And for people to write their own songs, that's what folk people did. That's what folk music was about. So this was huge. Everything about the Beatles, writing their own songs, having the long hair, nobody had hair like that. Playing their own instruments and singing the songs instead of instrumentals.
That covered their ears.
Yeah, and it was almost too much. It was almost like the revolution was didn't just kickstart. It like blew open the whole doors and windows and it. Everybody, and I've heard this over and over again, not being there at the time, I probably would have done it myself if I was at that age, but not being at the time, it's hard to remember, but everything I heard was, we got to start a band. Got to start a band, because they can do it. They're just guys. They're like 21 years old, and they're playing. So all of a sudden, all these bands start coming. Like, everybody wants to sign the bands from Britain.
Yeah, a big part of that is also, you know, when they see Elvis or when they see the Beatles and they see all those young women in the crowd just losing their minds.
Oh, of course.
Well, that's interesting.
That's sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That is really what it is. That is like, and of course, everybody thought that you only do it for a couple of years. Popular music was something like, oh, we can catch on, get a lot of birds, as they say.
Yeah, yeah.
And make some money to, and then start your life later on.
I mean, a lot of the 50s artists didn't have too many things in the charts at that time, so that's why they came to that conclusion.
So that was big, and like I said, nobody thought you'd be doing it 50 years later, 60 years later now. No, nobody thought
that you'd be doing it. Yeah, it wasn't a lifetime thing.
It wasn't a lifetime. Nobody ever said it was a lifetime.
Maybe if you played in a symphony orchestra, then you could do it for a lifetime.
Yes. There were music like jazz. You could do the rest of your life if you didn't die from a heroin overdose.
But, or any other jazz-related deaths.
So it was... So 64 was really the revolution. It's called, and it was an invasion. It was a British invasion. Unfortunately, a lot of American groups were not prepared, like the British groups were, because they were all playing in 1963 and 1962. It's just that they were playing the same places the Beatles were playing, and they were playing Hamburg, where nobody was really listening or signing them. Now they were all getting signed. The Americans were caught off guard, because now the musicians are just starting to form bands because they saw the Beatles. Oh, we got to form bands. And then, of course, that floodgate opened, but that took another year. The only band that they had was the Beach Boys to combat that. And they did well. They did extremely well.
Yeah, they did extremely well,
but that was pretty much it. They had to really get their shit together quickly.
The Birds and because, the Lovin' Spoonful.
Yes, the Birds.
A year later.
Perfect example. The Birds were a folk act. Roger McGuinn was a heavy folk person. They saw the Beatles not only on Ed Sullivan, which they said, we got to be an electric band now. We got to get a drummer, you know, and all that stuff. And they all agreed. And then they saw Hard Day's Night in the summer. And then it was like, yes, now look, George Harrison's playing a Rickenbacker 12 string on a Hard Day's Night. Roger McGuinn said, I got to get up.
Yeah, one of those guys.
And again, that little thing, just because George Harrison was playing a Rickenbacker, a whole sound was born with the Birds, with the 12-string electric guitar and the whole, what they call folk rock. I don't know, you'd call it folk rock. It was more, I don't know what it was called, but it was a whole different type of music. And then all these things, all the Kinks. The Kinks were always there too. The Kinks were always there. They didn't get to release music until, but they released it about the same time the Beatles did, you know, early 64, but they were always there. So that's why 1964 was the beginning of the rock and roll era as we know it. Especially when it was such a dire period. From 1959 to 63.
Yeah, and the mid-50s, you had that burst of the musical life, and then it kind of died down.
It kind of died,
It was there, and it was going to go away.
I think everybody knows why, but we'll tell you, like, Chuck Berry got arrested for the Mann Act, which is transporting a girl across state lines. He was in prison. Elvis joined the army, and for 2 years, then when he came back, he became more of a, less of a rebellious rock and roll singer. Buddy Holly died, Ritchie Valens died, you know, and the Big Bopper.
The Big Bopper.
Dilly Lillies and a pretty face. You remember Big Bopper's daughter, Sue Bopper?
Sue Bopper.
That's from an old SCTV skit. I had to bring that up because I thought of it when I was doing research for the show. Sue Bopper, she did a great play, I'm Putting My
Head With On. Libby Wilson.
Yeah.
I'm putting my head on straight, and no guy's going to tell me that it ain't. No, I'm taking my head, screwing it on right. Ah, whatever.
And no guy's going to tell me that it ain't. And Jerry Lee Lewis, of course, was banned because of marrying his cousin. I don't get the problem.
Yeah, I don't see the problem there.
13-year-old cousin, what's wrong?
And the only guy who stays married all his career.
And of course, Little Richard went into the ministry for... quite a while, and literally overnight everybody was gone. Literally overnight there was no leaders anymore, and that's when people like Dick Clark said, you know, we can fill that void with less rebelliousness and more clean-cut guys.
Yeah.
and girls, and that's from 1959 to 63. That was really popular, and you had your Fabians and your Frankie Avalons, and they took over the charts. And people thought that rock and roll as we knew it was going to die. And it seemed like it was going to die, even though there was people recording, they just weren't buying them like they do now. People were recording, but they just didn't have that wave. And if it wasn't for the Beatles, who knows what would have happened? And it just didn't take the Beatles. It took the Stones. It took the Who. And it took the Kinks and all the other bands that came along. It was... It's hard to say what the biggest year of rock and roll is. I know we talked about this when I was doing this segment about what's the biggest year, what's the hugest year that rock and roll or music has ever had. Pretty tough to top the beginning of rock and roll because it has to start somewhere, and when it started, it changed the culture, but it really changed the culture in 64. Everybody started to, I believe when the Beatles started and the people started to grow their hair and everything and dress the way they wanted to, that was the start of the counterculture. And that may make 64 the biggest year in rock and roll history. And I'm not going to, you know, this segment is not to talk about what songs are popular. You can look that up anywhere. What we're here to talk about is the culture of each year that we're talking about.
I mean, look at the look of people. They changed after 1964.
That's what I mean. Not only did the music change, which was drastic change. It was harder. It was still poppy, but it was harder. You had guitars now, two guitars. And
yep.
And it was the attitude. It was the reform of rebelliousness now, not only in just... Oh, screw you, Pop. It was now more like, I'm going to wear long hair. I'm going to dress the way I want. Now, that kind of didn't happen overnight, but that was the start of it because it really more fully took bloom in 66 and 67 with the Summer of Love and stuff like that before the hippies really started to dress like they want and wear their hair really long.
Yeah.
But this was the start of it, saying, you know what? Now our heroes... are 21-year-olds who are telling us what to do. And Dylan, had a lot, especially when he went electric. And all of a sudden, we have a young guy who's barely 25 years old who's telling us how to live our lives as academic a way as Shakespeare did. And big too. When you got somebody who's up there and he's not just singing She Loves You, She Loves You. Yeah. He's singing...
It's a thing where you can have a song where you have one point to make, or you can have a song where... you got the one point to make, but you eloquently... where you only say one thing in a song, or where you can say... What am I trying to say here? He did it better.
You have different points of view, is what you're saying. You don't just have one song. You have many songs about many different things.
In a song, you know, you're sifting through the whole song. You find that one line. That's it. That's all there is to it. And with Dylan, he spends the whole song explaining the point of view.
Totally agree. Of course, that happened in 65. But we're telling about the reverberations of 64. And I do believe, I think if I have to say that as big as... the mid-50s were, we covered 1956. We're talking about 1954. When we talk about that explosion of rebellion, which was needed, oh my God, it was needed. Everybody dressed the same, and kids were expected to dress the same. That was big, but it almost died. This changed the world.
Yeah, because it spread
changed
out
the world. It changed the way people dress. Yes,
the Russia that went to.
Yes, it changed the way what young people drank. All of a sudden, you don't tell if we want to drink Coke, we drink Coke. If my parents drink Pepsi, fuck you. It's your business. And that may seem simple, but all these things add up. And that's why it took a little while for the counterculture to take over, which it did. We live in the counterculture. You see people every day nowadays, 60 years later, dressed in the most outrageous garb that you can imagine, and nobody blinks an eye. You know why? This may be oversimplification, but I'm not. I'm totally serious. That goes back to that day on February 9th, 1964, when that was the first day that I feel that that little wave that started and got bigger and bigger and bigger as the years went by, started on that day where they said, you know, we can look the way we want, we can form our own bands, we can be spokesmen instead of listening to who you tell us is our spokesman. And yeah, music is not a fad. This is going to stay, and we love it, and we're actually going to make this better as the years go by. We're going to make it more complex. There's no end to what we can do with music, and it all started on that, the Beatles coming to North America.
Yeah, it's a heck of a thing. I mean, you want to be a musician, you want to sell your songs, but you got to go through a record company, you need other people's approval. I understand that, but for the first time, you had guys approving music not based upon, it's like this other stuff, which is safe. It's like, this is weirder than anything I've ever heard. Let's try it.
Yes, that's a very good point.
Let's try it.
You know what? I don't understand it, but I think the kids are going to like it, because that's what they're starting to like. They're starting to like things that are not so cookie cutter.
Yep.
So let's go try it. This group is pretty rough. Like the Animals. Yeah. I can imagine signing the Animals
bunch of those
and saying those guys are pretty rough and they look so scrungy. They look like animals. That's why they call them. Let's sign them, though, because they may catch on, and they did. And I don't want to get too much into this because we're running out of time for one. but really, we're just belaboring the same point, in that I feel maybe so far, that as far as we've done it, that 64 could be the biggest year, because it totally changed the world. Not overnight, but the way we live today, everything that you see today that is an advancement in society goes back to the British invasion and the kids and the Beatles on Ed Sullivan and all of 1964.
Yeah. And the world was ready for it, that's for sure.
And the world was ready for it. They were ready for it. They were almost, it was like being in a 5-year cocoon and from 1959 to 1964 of, oh, this is how music was in the early 50s. Oh my God, this sucks. And this is how it's going to be. And then it was like, no, it's actually better. And that's why I tell people, whenever there's always the bemoaning of rock is dead and rock will never sell again and blah, 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 I said, there's another band. I don't know when it's going to be, but they're going to be nobody's ever going to be as big as the Beatles, but they're going to be like a Nirvana, and they're going to be like a Sex Pistols, and they're going to be like a Beatles, and they're going to come up and you're going to say, wow. And then we take the stranglehold again. Because whenever you think rock's going to die and it hits a low point, somehow God says, I think the kids need another band.
60s and 70s music is still on playlists. It's still things being picked up by the kids, and they're enjoying it. Do you listen to much big band music?
No, that's the point, is that you hear the music of the 60s, 70s, and 80s on everything.
Yeah, it's in
you hear it in commercials, in movies, in TV, in sports broadcasts before they go to the... That was unheard of when I was watching sports in the 70s. They'd always have the strangest kind of, I don't know, I wouldn't say orchestra music, but kind of music.
Working for the station was...
Now you have to have some sort of popular music playing, either old or new. You have to have like...
You're really going to have Ozzy Osbourne's Crazy Train.
Yes, I've heard that. I've heard so many strange songs. We have overtaken the world with our music. The kids can tell you about how great... I'm talking about the kids that are 20 years old, 21. That listen to the pop music too. I'm not degrading that. But they say, oh, Led Zeppelin, man, they're great. And The Who, and I love them. This is, like you said, Rob said it very eloquently. In the 60s and the 70s, were you listening to big band music? No, you were listening to the rock and roll, and it had a staying power. I don't want to just keep on belaboring the same point, but there is differences at every point that we're making here. And it's that it's everything that happens, the things, commercials you hear with rock music, Nick Drake being played on the Volkswagen commercial. That's because of the Beatles. If the Beatles or the British invasion in 64 never happened, it might have happened, but it might have happened 20 years later that we would have gotten this, what we have now. Because we have such diversity and a change of culture, in simplistic terms, happens because of the bands in Britain that came over in 64 and said, kids can do it. Kids can rule the world. Kids can do this, not just music, but business and everything. And that's why, so far, I don't know, we're getting to 77 and stuff like that. I may change my mind, but 64 to me may be the most revolutionary year in rock and roll history, even more than the beginning of it.
There was definitely a time of change. It was the biggest year of change, I think.
I agree. And if people say it's not, then at least it was the seeds of the beginning of the change. Maybe the biggest change came with 66 and 67 when people started to... But all that had to have a place to start. And yeah, you know what? When you say that, Rob, yeah, it was the biggest change because then it was okay to wear long hair. And yeah, you got ribbed for it, but fuck you. You know what? I want to wear what I want to wear. And I want to be who I want to be. And... just like Ray Davies said, I'm not like everybody else.
Yeah. They can get you to look the same and talk the same. They can probably get you to do a whole bunch of other stuff. You got to fight back, people.
Yeah. That's the revolution right there, though, Rob. Right there. The way that you can say, you know what, you want me to take this job or whatever. Well, you know what, I don't want to do that job. I'm sorry. 20 years ago, you could make me do that job. You can't make me do what I don't want to do anymore. This is what I want to do. Sometimes it works out good. Sometimes
and if you're
an
employer, when you're advertising for the job, you just put that clause: long-haired freaky people need not apply.
And you know what? It's so funny. You put that down just by a joke. Everybody knows that they couldn't do that. I know that people in the 70s understand this. You grew up in the 70s. But you write that down and you get a few people who would know that. Now, everybody would know that line and go, oh, yeah, that's by that group. Yeah, I love that song.
Long hair.
And you could do that for almost any song in the 60s, 70s, and even 80s. Yeah. You know, you just mention a lyric or something like, oh, yeah, I like that song. And it comes from people who are 60, 70, 75, because that's, hey, those kids that were rebelling in 60s and 64... a lot of them are passed on. That's how old they're getting.
I can quote old songs, and the kids kind of get where they come from. I quote old TV shows, and nothing.
Yeah, nothing. Nothing. Yeah, you know, the amount of lyrics or music that the kids or the culture in it, the pop culture can identify with specific lyrics or songs from the 60s, 70s, and 80s is absolutely stunning. And I don't think we'll ever get that again. Common agreement on three decades, 30 years of music.
I think to get something like that, it'll be 20 years after the Earth goes through, the humans on Earth go through a really long, shitty period. And then about 20 years after that, we might have another explosion of culture.
Oh, we're way over time.
So we have to...
I just realized that when I add the time together, we're so over time.
Oh, yeah, we're about 49, 50 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, we haven't even started.
Okay, we're going to do our 3-minute review of the album.
The album we are reviewing this week is by jazz guitarist Al Di Meola, called Elegant Gypsy, released in 1977. And Al Di Meola, it's like I said, he looks older than he is. I don't mean that in a because right now I see pictures of Al Di Meola and he looks like he's 45 and he's actually almost 70. So it's like he's never changed. He does. He looks amazingly young. I'm looking at a picture of him right now on my computer from 10 years ago when he would have been like in his early 60s. And I swear to God, he looks like he's 35 years old. So here's a guy that's never changed his how he looks. But he always seemed to be, he was on all those magazines. And I would read about him just because, you know, my brother would bring him home. All the guitar magazines. And I would go, oh, and I never heard his music. But I knew so much about him. Not personally, but about his music and what he played that it's funny, it took me like 45 years to finally hear his, well, I finally got to hear his guitar playing when we did the Return to Forever, which I loved. I mean, it was just a stinging rock guitar in the middle of this crazy jazz fusion. And then this, you know, with his solo career, this is only his second solo album, which I didn't know. He's a very young guy. He was born in 1954. He was born in New Jersey. He doesn't look like he was a guy born in Jersey City, New Jersey. He looks like he looks like a guy who was born in Italy, like actual Italy. You know, he has a very rich ethnic look, like he can hardly speak English. But this guy born in Jersey City.
Yeah, with his name, I always for years never thought he was American. I thought he was like Central American or Spanish.
Yeah, and especially because the first album I ever heard of from him, and this goes back to 45 years ago, was Elegant Gypsy. And here he's dressed up and he's got, and it is.
And all the song titles.
It looks very European and South American.
Places where.
Yes. Yes, that's what I mean. It's from places
warmer
from South
places.
America. So you think that maybe he's South American or Italian or something?
Mediterranean or, yeah.
So to find out that he was just this 22-year-old, 23-year-old from New Jersey
guy.
Of course, everybody, I hope everybody who follows jazz remembers that he was in the great group Return to Forever, which he joined in 1974 as a guitarist. And he was even as he was recording this album, Elegant Gypsy, in 1977, he was still in Return to Forever. I think he left in 1978. I really like that album by Chick Corea's Return to Forever. We reviewed it.
That was the other one, yeah.
Yeah, I really like that album. It had a real earthiness to it. It had a real rock kind of, you know, on the floor type of thing. Like, it was really rough. You know how I like rough music, kind of rough.
Yeah,
like we're just gonna play and it's loud, and it just didn't seem like jazz fusion. Weather Report was like jazz fusion, in your case to the worst side of it, because it was very slick and it had great playing on it with Jaco Bisterius and everything. But Return to Forever was more like, let's rock it up, man, while we're jazzing.
Yeah.
So I'm a big fan of Return to Forever. And you know, and Al Di Meola, like, he had a big hit with this album. And he was very big with musicians and the, you know, the affluent type of snobby musicians in the late 70s.
The snobby musician crowd.
Yes. Who like, oh yeah, well, if you don't listen to Al Di Meola on guitar, then you're nowhere,
I've
man.
I've got no time to talk to you. We're clearly on different levels. Mine
exactly.
is above yours.
Because even though Al Di Meola, as far as a commercial aspect, kind of fell by the wayside as the 80s came by, because jazz really commercially died after the 70s. It really did. We're not joking about that. That's a fact. You know, like all the other jazz musicians, didn't care, just released albums and toured. And he, of course, like every other jazz musician that has extreme amount of talent, he's released about 30, 40 albums. And he just plays as he wants. And, you know, I don't think a lot of them wanted a lot of jazz players don't want the notoriety, especially with the kind of 70s notoriety, which was maybe a really big. There's a difference between 1940s and 1950s notoriety in jazz.
You want to be
comfortable. And 1970s notoriety. We talked about this last week with George Benson, how he was huge at the same time period as Al Di Meola. And a lot of jazz people, the late 70s was for jazz fusion guys, was just huge for them. And I don't think a lot of them liked it. I think that these guys were born on, we live the music first, and all that other stuff is bullshit. I'm not saying I don't want to speak for either George Benson or Al Di Meola.
That's the impression you get, though.
But that's the impression you get, exactly. So he's kind of doing his own thing. He looks incredibly young. He looks like he could be doing it for another 20 years at least. And so we get to the album. And I really liked it. I have to admit, I am a jazz fan. As I have to say over and over again, because we make so many jokes about it. But we're just joking. We don't really mean it. I mean, we mean it about sales and people not buying it, but we don't mean it as crappy music. We just mean that we don't love everything about it, but I like a lot about jazz. I actually do.
Yeah.
And
not,
especially when we get into jazz fusion, I really like jazz fusion.
I'm not particularly down on any style. There's just styles that don't move me.
Yes.
That's
Yes, and I think jazz is very varied, that it can be like that. Like, it's like, wow, I don't like this guy, but this other guy is. And especially when you got a guitar player. Like when you got a guitar player zinging like rock type of playing with that, you know, like a Les Paul. You know when you have a Gibson Les Paul, you know this. That it's going to be stinging. Nobody plays a Gibson Les Paul except Les Paul himself. When he played, plays it really like, you know, like without distortion or anything.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. When you have a when you see a guy on a cover with a Les Paul, he's going to be cranking that thing. And what I like about it, first of all, it is kind of a concept record, and that it's built around Spanish and Latin music and South American music, kind of a hybrid of that. Because if you're thinking it's like Spanish music, it's not.
No,
it's jazz fusion. It's rock and it's acoustic, but
takes influences from the.
Influences. Yeah. I'm trying to find the right words. Yeah. It takes influences from it, but if you're thinking that you're going to be listening to Spanish music, you're wrong. It's actually a very jazz fusion album. I was really taken with the two guitars, acoustic guitar songs on here. Mediterranean Tango? Sundance, that Aldi Meola plays on the guitar with Paco de Lucia, who is a very, very popular Spanish guitarist. It's just I listened to it. I'm spellbinded.
I spent half that song wondering, are there two guitars? And then by the second half, and you're hearing the rhythm and the lead, not possibly playing, that it can't possibly be one guy. Yeah, that's when I realized.
But that. He does overdub, because he did do the other acoustic instrumental, Lady of Rome, Sister of Brazil, which you can obviously tell Lady of Rome, Sister of Brazil means he's Italian. With a love of Brazilian South American music by the title. Get it? Anyways. he does play that all by himself, but of course he overdubs the two guitars so that you can hear them. So I can understand why you can say, hey, that's two guitars playing. I just love those two instrumentals. In fact, I really got into Lady of Rome, Sister Brazil, and it's only like a minute and 46 seconds, and I was going, I love this. Why does this end so quick? And I loved... I actually like so much on this. I liked Race with the Devil on Spanish Highway, because he makes the guitar sound like it's racing on a highway. I don't know if you can imagine that in your head, but he actually does that, and it has things to it. I don't know. I like this more. I heard it, the more it really got to me, the more that I knew it was structured, yet it had a great raw feel to it.
Yeah, you know, the when they're doing something, it seems to go for the right length of time. It's never too long.
Exactly. Which could be a problem with me and jazz. I think it's a problem probably with you and jazz,
yes,
too.
I hear
or 20-minute songs or 25
minutes.
It can
be too long for my... it's like I drift out, I drift back in again. Why am I listening to this?
Now, an important thing I should point out about jazz fusion and why I like it so much compared to 40... years before that of acoustic jazz, is that in acoustic jazz, what you would do is that people would play, there wouldn't be much dynamics, because people would, you'd get your Charlie Parker on his playing his solos, and then right after that, you know, get your trumpet player, if maybe Miles Davis playing his solos, and you get the bass player playing the solo, and then the drummer would do a solo, and that's, you know, and it could get mixed up, and maybe sometimes the bass player didn't do a solo, you know what I mean, but there wasn't a lot of dynamics to it. It was a lot of soloing.
When I was taking jazz, one of the most annoying things to me was the jazz bass solos back in the old days were played on the big stand-up bass.
Yeah, that's
what I mean. If you wanted to hear them, the band pretty much had to drop out so the bass guy could solo. And even with the electric instruments in college, everyone would still drop out when I tried to do a solo. And I'm like, it's electric. Why are you guys doing this?
But that's the thing that I really like about jazz fusion, is because you use electric instruments. I'm not talking about the solos necessarily, but you can change the parts. You can have different sections to it, and you can drop the music down completely, where it's almost impossible to do with acoustic instruments.
The first comment I put down listening to this album was that I really like the upfront backing music.
Yes. Yes. That's basically in that sentence is what I like about jazz fusion, is that unlike all the jazz that came before 1970, you can work with it.
Yeah.
In terms of dynamics, in terms of, oh, it's just the guitar playing now. And then it starts off into, I heard that, I think it was in, I can't remember which song it is now. It could have been Elegant Gypsy Suite. I think when all of a sudden everything dies down and then all of a sudden it's just Al Di Meola playing the rhythm guitar for a little bit, going into another section. And I said, you couldn't do that before. First of all, because guitar wasn't an instrument really. In the way that it became up until the late 60s with John McLaughlin playing in Miles Davis's band and everything. And so now you could do that. But now you got electric instruments, kind of like we can go off. It's not it's not just soloing. Everybody gets a solo and the song's done. And then you play the opening hook and then the song's over. This is more of a rock compositions, what jazz fusion is, in that it can turn into three or four different songs in there. Mm-hmm. And you're not stuck with the same type of regiment for 8 minutes long. That's why it got boring to me.
The Flight Over Rio, the first one where it starts off, I think the first minute and a half or 2 minutes is that cool instrumental thing with the keyboards.
Yes.
Which is definitely a part. There's no improvised playing. Then it goes in about 4 or 5 minutes of the improvising. And then it goes back into that part for the end of the song, which...
And that's cool because you don't have to just... solo over the part. Yeah, you can make up a whole new part for the solo.
And they had a couple parts in that which no one was which weren't being soloed over. Which
exactly, I'm, it was
don't
just
hear too much.
It was just sections. It would be just a different section. You didn't. There was no soloing, and it was like that is why, unlike Branford Marsalis would say, or Winton, I can't remember which one. They're interchangeable.
I think
they're both very anti-fusion. They don't think that jazz should
have... more into the classical jazz.
Yes.
Okay.
Of course, I'm biased because I'm a rock and roll guy.
Yeah.
And I like electricity.
Yes.
But this is why I think it's much more flexible. Yes, I guess when their point about you lose the solos, but you gain the songs, I think.
Yeah.
I think you really gain... the essence of songs and be able to change them and be able to have dynamics. And there's, I think there's so much added in jazz fusion. And
in jazz fusion, for me, there's a little bit more for my ears and brain to grip onto. The old style jazz, it kind of, I'm made of wax and it's water and it just rolls right off me.
I'll give you an example, Rob, because that's a good point. I'm going to give you an example. When... you playing 1970s jazz, like Al Di Meola, and you're coming in, you could play like really nice chords or whatever to start the song, and then it's your solo, you can come in, put on that gain on your switch, on your guitar, and come in with a blistering solo that you couldn't come in, and it means so much more than just coming in with an acoustic instrument playing at the same type, where you have to blow the same type of volume, but you can't come in like that in acoustic music in that sort of degree. But you can with an electric instrument, whether it be the keyboards or whether it be the bass guitar or whether it be the guitar, you can come in blazing and then you can actually turn that gain off and be very fluid. And that's the beauty to me of the jazz that I like. And that's why I'm not dismissing acoustic jazz, because a lot of it I do like, most of Miles Davis. But when people say you don't like jazz, I say, you know what? I love jazz fusion. And that's why I like Return to Forever, because they were very much like that. They were very much, and Mahavishnu Orchestra was very much dynamic. And it was very much electric. And all of a sudden, they come in with a blazing solo. And it raises you up.
Yes.
And it gives you the feeling of the song where you couldn't get that with other jazz. You had to rely on the playing, not the sound of the instrument. The sound of the instrument can give you a feeling of the song just as much as the playing can. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. Because, like I said last time, listening to George Benson, the one comment I made that his acoustic guitar playing, I wasn't a big fan of his sound.
That yes, you had said that his guitar sound was...
I loved his playing, but that kind of... it almost sounded a bit muffled.
Yeah, it was. It was very well. It was almost. I don't think there was any distortion on it. I don't think there was any gain on it whatsoever. And that
this with the electric guitar though, it really. I don't know.
But this is Al Di Meola. This is different. I disagree with you on a little bit, just because it was George Benson. Because I do agree with your point.
Like you said, you like the sound.
I just think it fit George Benson's music and his guitar playing. But normally, I would agree with you 100% in that I like varied guitar sounds, because you can go from, oh, this is meant to be moody, and then all of a sudden it jumps into like a very heightened state, like we do with Race with Devil on Spanish Highway. It has a fastest, but then it goes into a double fastest where he kind of with his guitar, so it sounds like a car driving too fast. Yeah,
what's that one song? A little night traveler was following me. There's one where I keep speeding up there.
Yeah,
horn went beep beep beep.
Oh well, we won't get into that. But I know what you're talking about.
No, that's another way to use music to express some emotion. Yeah.
Oh my God. It's not too bad. I'm looking at the time. I'm sorry. I was looking at the people going, why is he saying, oh my God? But actually, it's not too bad. Before we rate this album, and I give it to Rob to see if he has anything more to say.
I just got a few more things to add.
I just want to say the people who play on this album. I already said Paco de Lucia, who is a world-renowned Spanish guitarist. We have Jan Hammer. Everybody
Jan
knows
Hammer on Jan keys. Hamburgers, I'm like, who's that keyboard player? I didn't get any information on this one, but fuck, that guy.
Of course,
good.
We know him for playing on Jeff Beck's albums. Mm-hmm. He was in the Mahavishnu Orchestra, as we know. Which we are big fans of. And, of course, everybody knows him for composing all the music for Miami Vice, was exceptional music.
That's where I
exceptional mood music for a moody show. You couldn't find anybody better.
A moody rock and roll show.
A moody rock and roll show.
Let's make MTV Cops.
It was an MTV show, actually.
MTV Cops.
Everybody says it was MTV Cops. And the great Jan Hammer, still around, I think. Let me just check.
Pretty sure. Yeah, if he had passed, we would have heard about it.
Yep. We have Lenny White, who also was in Return to Forever on drums, great drummer. And for one song on the Elegant Gypsy Suite, we have the great Steve Gadd on drums. Steve Gadd has played with everybody, and he's played on every session. He's one of the greatest drummers in the world. Everybody knows him as being Paul Simon's drummer. He's the guy who plays on 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover with a dum 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 dum. Which is really hard. It sounds simple, but try and play that. I have tried to play it many times. I'm a half-assed drummer, and I always think I can play the.
We're gonna see Carter can do it.
We're gonna get our young protege on drums, Carter, to try and play that next time. I remember that.
I'll read the lyrics. I'll sing it.
We got back Jack and Steve Gadd is just amazing. You may not know his name, but he's on everything, and he's played with everybody. And this album made it to number 58 in the Billboard 200 in 1977, which is an amazing accomplishment for an instrumental jazz album.
Yeah, instrumental.
At any time. And it was number 5 top jazz album in 1970. That's the highest position it got. That's why I said it was so popular. I look at the charts and I just remember there was ads for this album in like Cream magazine and Rolling Stone, and I was going, and it never left me. It was like, oh, Elegant Gypsy. That's probably the only album I remember because it was so heavily promoted and it was so popular. The fans loved it.
Normally you hear songs on the radio and DJ would tell what the song is and that's how you remember it. But this had saturation everywhere else.
Yes, this was a time in music where you could actually sell a record without like AM airplay.
Yeah.
If you had a good word of mouth, and jazz people were much more prominent, buyers were much more prominent than, then they kind of died in the 80s. And sadly, you know, we don't like to see any music be on the extreme fringe. As they say, there's like 2% of people in the world buy jazz music, which we have used as a joke, but it's not really funny because no music should be that much put on the sidelines. But after the hoopla of jazz fusion, nothing really happened after, you know, in the 80s after that, except for the Rocket by Herb Hancock. It's the only thing I can remember.
The Marcellus Brothers bringing back old jazz.
And the Marcellus Brothers bringing back the old jazz. But I swear to God, I have heard very little jazz since the beginning of the 80s. Seriously, like very little. It's being made. I see 50 albums by George Benson. I see 40 albums by Aldi Meola. But I have heard nothing about them. You know, I've heard nothing from Return to Forever since the 70s. I've heard nothing from the Mahavishnu Orchestra since the 70s. It's like jazz as a commercial vehicle just fell off the end of the world.
Weird.
It is weird. And you know what? That we don't get to hear albums like this because they're not promoted. But I really like this album. I give it 4 stars. I at one time was thinking of giving it 4.5. I'm going to give it 4.5. I actually think this album had such an impact on me as far as this is the kind of jazz that I like. It really is, especially with guitar in it. It speaks to my rock and roll heart, and I give it 4.5. And I'm going to give it to Rob.
It's varied, but it's good all over. Two things I want to mention. First of all, I was talking about the upfront backing music. I used to have a guitarist I played with. He was a big Stevie Ray Vaughan fan. And I think he kind of wanted to play some Stevie Ray Vaughan. And
was that Tom?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tom Wilkes. And
Tom Wilkes.
Yeah.
Because you know that our Tom, who passed away, was a huge Stevie Ray Vaughan fan.
Yeah, we've known many Toms. We have to short Tom, tall Tom.
But anyway. I didn't know Tom Wilkes was actually a big Stevie Ray Vaughan fan. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and the problem I had with playing the Stevie Ray Vaughan is the backup music, they kind of laid back a lot more than I like to.
Mm-hmm.
They're still really good, don't get me wrong, but I always thought, you know, you could be having a great time playing this, but I'd just be boom, 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 you know, trudging along. That does not happen here.
There's your punchline. And it's just trudging. But I don't have it here.
That does not happen. These guys are there. They're doing that thing. They're wonderful.
That's your surprise. That's your twist ending right there.
Everyone's playing this music, damn it. Al is great. He's done some great work. But everyone's doing really good stuff on this.
You got you when you got that kind of musicianship, don't you? Really? I mean,
yeah.
You got the best. You got the best bass player. You got the best drummers that you can find. You got the best keyboard players you can find. I mean, how can you fuck up? Really?
You'd have to go drinking the night before. That's all I can think.
That's a rock and roll thing to do.
And the other thing I want to mention was the new sounds I'm hearing on this that I don't hear too much. I haven't heard in previous years. One is the bass. Listening to that, I thought originally it had a phaser on it. Because it would, but if it had a phaser on it, it would have a regular kind of rhythm to that phasing, and I didn't hear that. So I think what he had on that was compression, and I know I started hearing that a lot.
It was
after the
it was
70s and in the 80s.
I don't know exactly what it was, but you were right, and I knew we would talk about this.
That was a new kind of thing.
Yes,
that had the bass sound there.
Yes, that was an effect, though. That was the bass. So some people might think it was the keyboard or something, but that was the bass.
That was the bass, but yeah, it had the, I don't know what effect it was. I suspect compression, but...
And you know what? I heard, since I hate to cut you off, but I'll forget if I don't mention this, and there's also an effect that Aldi Meola uses on one of his... Which I don't know what it is either, but you can tell that it almost sounds like a keyboard, but it's his guitar playing. And
that's right. I was trying to figure out if it's keys or guitar.
Yeah, it was. And I remembered those two things about the bass having an effect, but I can't place either effect.
I know. And the third thing that was unusual, the last song, "Elegant Gypsy Suite," where Jan Hammer is playing his keyboard solo. Was something else that I don't hear in a lot of previous music. On the old Yamaha DX7 keyboards, on the very left, they had that one knob that you push forward or backward, the pitch bender.
Yeah.
So he was doing a solo with a pitch bending keyboard.
I remember that now.
Uh-huh. I have not heard any previous music. So there was a whole bunch of new technology.
I can even hear it in my. I can hear it in my head now as you're saying it too.
They were playing with the new stuff that hadn't come out before. So that's another thing that makes this album rather unique.
Yeah, the effects. Just those three effects. I mentioned the Aldi Meola one, but those two effects that you mentioned and the one that I are I think pretty glaring. But they're not glaring in that, they're out of place. They're glaring in that, wow, it's pretty
cool.
cool new
thing that you had not heard before. But yeah, I gave it 4 stars. I was trying to rate. I really like this one. I like George Benson. Which one do I like more? And I like them both about the same. They're kind of But they're different. They're two sides of the same coin. They're...
Yeah, you know, I actually thought the same thing. I really did. I thought, do I like this? But I said, you know what? George is George, and he does things his way. More old-fashioned type of jazz fusion. More R&B, because he puts the R&B and singing in there, which gives him a little bit of an advantage because it gives him a more variety. But this was also very inventive. It is kind of like apples and oranges because they're so different, really. Yes. And that's why...
They're both jazz fusion, but they're...
I both had them for, but then I said, you know what? Elegant Gypsy was like really more, tough to do as a studio project, and it really, it had the effects. It had more because it was a studio album, whereas George's flowed so good, but it was a live album, and he couldn't put those effects or do the fancy stuff that he wanted to do.
No, yeah, there's no experimenting on stage with sounds. I mean, there is a bit, but...
And I think that's why I had to give it 4.5, because... I think eventually I would give it 4.5. I might not now. Right now, after, you know, 3 or 4 listens, I give it 4. But I'm going to listen to this album more because I really like it. And I know that I'm going to bump this up to 4.5.
George is good, but just the energy here.
Yeah.
The rock and
roll. I got the same energy that I did when we listened to Return to Forever and the Mahavishnu Orchestra. I got that same type of, it's jazz, but it's also rock. You know, like, there's that rock and roll heart to it, and there's that experimental heart to it, and there's that, I wouldn't say a non-jazz kind of fuck you jazz. I wouldn't say that, but I would say that there's a fuck you to the old way of jazz.
This is old way of jazz. It can jump at times, but it's more laid back for the most part. It's more swinging, and this is a bit more rocking.
Yeah. Just like the Return to Forever was for me, because it had some a rootsy type of very like. Turn up your guitar, and I'll turn up my organ, and we're gonna put da da da, and that's why it attracted me so much. It was like playing jazz while you're got your head in the rock and roll, your mind in a rock and roll headset. You know, it's like, my headset's in rock and roll, but we gotta play jazz. And I swear, I listened to that Return to Forever and the Mahavishnu Orchestra so many times. That's the jazz I like.
Yeah.
I'm not, that doesn't mean I don't like the acoustic jazz. But this is definitely. But this is almost always, I say I like this. When I listen to jazz fusion. Yeah, it's a step up for me. I know for a lot of people, like the Marsalis brothers, is a step down, each to their own. Yeah. I love this type of stuff. Next week, we're going to have something very similar to that. And I was wrong. I was going to write that Rob would kind of like this album, but bemoan jazz again. I'm sorry, I was wrong. That's what I was going to write down on my piece of paper.
It's definitely a bias of the rock and roll instrumentation and sounds.
It is. It's our bias because that's the way we grew up. Yeah. And Winton and Bradford Marsalis grew up with a jazz father. And I understand that. But this is our bias. And it really gets to us. It really does. Mm. So that's our show for this week.
That's it.
Yep.
I'm done.
Hopefully Rob will come back next week for the last in our series of jazz guitar albums.
On my way out today, I was thinking, geez, I got to put the kibosh in. There's no more jazz. But then I remembered what the show was about, and we can't exclude anyone.
This show, it really is. You know what? And I kind of even thought, and I know we're way over time now. We're verging on longest show ever time. But I have to say, I feel bad thrusting this at Rob because I know we have to do bass guitar albums and we have to do drumming albums. Okay. And I said, should I stop that? Because that's we're going to do it every
year.
We had
a year or two between each.
No, we'll do this the same time next year. But then I thought, no, if we give it a year... And that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to explore every type of music that falls into the rock and roll popular music vein. And it's not terrible. And Rob doesn't cringe at it. It's just not his favorite music, that's all.
No. I have little memory of it.
That's the problem with me and you. I think it's a problem with rock and roll people with jazz is where memory is such an important part of songs.
It has to. A song has to have something you can grip onto, and you just bounce off this stuff.
So I don't want this to be the longest show ever.
That's it.
Because I said we weren't going to do that anymore.
No.
So this is it. We're done for today. Until next week, everybody. Please take care. and stay safe. Just right or wrong.